Audio Renaissance presents The Greys by Whitley Strieber. Read for you by Stephen Lang. Part 1. Night Flyers.
Who's in the next room? Who? I seem to hear somebody muttering firm in a language new that chills the ear. No. You catch not his tongue who has entered there. Thomas Hardy. Who's in the next room? 1. Because we know it is there, danger in an obvious place, on a battlefield, say, is often far less of a threat than it is on a quiet street in a small town. For example, on a street deep in America where three little boys rode interlocking figure eights on their bicycles, and on a sweet May evening, too, any danger would be a surprise, and a great and terrible danger, impossible. Not all of the boys were in danger. In fact, two of them were as profoundly safe as anybody else in Madison, Wisconsin, on the scented evening of May 21st, 1977. The third boy, however, was not so lucky. Not nearly. Because of something buried deeply in his genes, he was of more than normal interest to someone that is supposed not to exist, but does exist, in fact, is master of this earth. It was too bad for this child, in fact tragic, because these creatures, if they could even be called that, caused phenomenal trauma, scarring trauma, to those of their victims who lived. Play ended with the last of the sun and lights glowed on the porches of Woody Lane, as one by one the boys of the lane retired. Danny rode a little longer and was watched by Burley, the dog of Mr. Amer. Soon Mr. Amer himself came across his lawn. His pipe glowed as he drew on it, and he said, "Say there, Danny, you want to come night fishing with me and your Uncle Frank? We've been getting some good uns all this week." Danny was a lonely child, saddled with an alcoholic mother and a violent father, so he welcomed these chances to be away from the tensions of home. He could take his sleeping bag and unroll it in the bottom of the boat, and if his line jerked, it would wake him up, but not tonight. "I got scouts real early," he said. "Gotta get up." Mr. Amer leaned back on his heels. "You're turning down fishing?"
"Gotta be at the park at 9. That means 7:30 mass."
"Well, yes, it does. It does at that." He drew on the pipe again. "We get a sturgeon, we'll name 'em for you."
He laughed then, a gentle rustle in his throat, in the first gusts of the wind that rises with the moon. He left Danny to go down the dark of Woody Lane alone, pushing the pedals of his Raleigh as hard as he could, not wanting to look up at the darkening sky again, not daring to look behind him. As he parked his bike and ran up to the lit back door, he was flooded with relief as he hopped on the doorstep and went into the lighted kitchen. He smelled the lingering odor of fried chicken, felt hungry, but knew there was none left in the house. He went into the living room. He didn't stay long. Love Boat was like a religion with Mom and Dad, and then came Fantasy Island. He'd rather be in his room with the Batman he'd bought from Ron Bloom for 20 cents. At the same moment, a few miles away, Caitlin Burns, who adored Love Boat, watched and received advice from her mother about painting her toenails. Very red, and use a polish that hardens slowly. They last longer, chip less, good on the toes. Next week school was out, and she had to paint her toenails for beach day. A magnetism of whispers that Joyce assumed were her own thoughts had drawn her to Madison, Wisconsin, and to this shabby apartment near the water. An easy place, Madison, the thoughts whispered to her, for a divorcee to find a man. An easy place, they most certainly did not tell her, from which to steal a child, carry her out and take her far, so that when her scream started, there would be none to hear her but the night wind. And so it would be this night, after the Love Boat sailed away, and silence filled the house. As Saturday evening ended, the moon rode over houses that one by one became dark. Madison slept in peace then, as the hours wore past midnight.
Sometime after 3, Danny Callahan became aware of a change around him, enough of a change to draw him out of sleep. He opened his eyes and saw nothing but stars. For a moment he thought he'd gone night fishing after all. Then he realized he was still in bed, and the stars were coming from his own home planetarium, bought from Edmund Scientific for $9. It was a dark blue plastic sphere with a light in it. The plastic was dotted with pinholes in the pattern of the night sky, and when you turned out the lights and turned the planetarium on, magic happened. The heavens appeared all around you. He hadn't turned the planetarium on, though, and that fact made the acid of fear rise in his throat. He opened his mouth to call for his dad, but there was no sound, just a puff of breath. As the stars crossed his face, twisting along his nose and across his eyes, his tears flowed in helpless silence. The only sounds were the humming of the planetarium's motor and the breeze fluttering the front yard oak. Dan sat up on the bedside. Like a man buttoning his coat for a journey, he buttoned his pajama top until all 4 big buttons were neatly closed. A thought whispered to him, "Stand up. Look out the window." He clutched the bedsheets with both hands. The old oak shook its leaves at him, and the thoughts whispered, "Come on. Come on." Then he knew that his toes had touched the floor, and he was up in the flowing stars. Then he floated to the window. As he moved closer, he saw it sliding open. Then he went faster and moved through it. He tried to grab the sash as he passed, but missed. Then he was moving through the limbs of the oak that stood in their front yard, struggling and grabbing at them. He got his arms around one, but his body turned upward until his feet were pointing at the sky. He held on with all his might, but the pull got stronger and stronger. "Dad!" he yelled as he was dislodged and drawn into the sky. He heard a dog raise a howl, and saw an owl below him, her wings glowing in the moonlight, her voice swept away by the wind. He rose, screaming and struggling, running in the air, clawing at emptiness. Far below him, moonlight danced on Lake Monona's baby waves, and then he was among the night clouds, and he flew in their canyons and soared across their hills and heard their baby thunder muttering. The wonder of it silenced his screams at last, but not the tears that poured down his face, or the trembling gasp that came when he slowly passed across the top of a cloud and saw so very far below the silver lake and the dots of light that were Madison. He closed his eyes and covered his face with his hands as he moved up toward what looked like a silver island in the sky. The island had a round opening in it, dark and black. Then Danny was through the round opening. He stopped in the air, then fell to a floor. Opening his eyes, he found himself in darkness, but not absolute darkness. Moonlight sifted in the opening. Far below, he could see the pinpricks of light that marked fishing boats on the lake's surface. A cold sorrow enveloped him. Now, here, he remembered this from before. He did not want the little doctors to touch him ever again. He knew also that they would, and soon. He thought of jumping back out through the opening, but what would happen then? He went closer to it, leaned out as far as he dared. "Mr. Amers! Uncle Frank! Help me! Please, Uncle Frank!" A rustling sound. He cringed closer to the edge, wishing he dared jump through. A voice whispered soft, "Hello?" He backed away from the form. He could see white, a white face, loose white clothes. "Help me," the form said. It was a girl. He could see that now, could hear it in her voice. She was standing on the far side of the opening in the floor, her face glowing in the faint moonlight that slanted in. "Are you from Madison?" she asked. Her voice trembled. "Yeah. I'm Danny Callahan. I'm Caitlin Burns. I never saw anybody else here before."
"Me neither."
"Where are we?"
"I'm not sure.
'Cause when I come here, I remember I was here before, but then when I go home, I don't remember anymore."
She lowered her head. Her voice dropped to a hesitant murmur.
"Do they take your clothes off, too?"
His face grew hot. He clutched his own shoulders. "Uh-huh.
They do stuff to me that's weird.
Some kind of operations." Her eyes flashed.
"Yes, but this isn't a hospital."
As the two children came together and held each other,
They were watched by cold and careful eyes. The embrace between the children extended, the girl in her nightgown, the boy in his pajamas, stained with yesterday's oatmeal. It had nothing to do with sex. They were too young. They were like two little birds stolen from the nest, trying to find some safety where there was none. "If we dive down to the lake, would that work, instead of just jumping?" Dan asked Caitlin. "I don't know. Maybe not. I've got a diving merit badge." "I'm going to try," he said. She sighed, understood. The children moved along a rickety catwalk, going closer to the opening they had been drawn through. The ship wasn't high-tech. It didn't even have a way of closing its hatch. It was old and handmade, but the materials involved were far in advance of our own. It was constructed of sticks that would not break or burn, and aluminum foil you could not penetrate even with a bullet. There were no glowing control panels, nothing like Star Trek, just tin foil and plywood, and a tin box full of an extraordinary substance mined out of the earth that resisted the pull of gravity. The creatures hiding near the children knew what they were thinking, because they could see not only their fleshy bodies wrapped in their fluttering cloth covers, but also their electric bodies, a shimmering network of lines that coursed through them, the fiery nerves that carried sensation and love and memory, and blue fear racing from the heart. They could see in the heads lines of gold and green changing to red and purple, and they knew that these were also the colors of fear. Caitlin and Dan gazed down at the shimmering, wrinkled surface of the lake. "You gonna?" Caitlin asked. Danny could imagine Mr. Amers on the lake smoking his pipe and watching his line. He took a deep breath. What would Mr. Amers see, though? A boy falling out of the sky? Maybe, but probably not. Probably they'd think the splash was just a fish jumping. Then he heard the fluttering sound in the dark that meant the things were on the move. Caitlin drew close to him, but then the slowest trace of a smile flickered on her lips, and she raised her hand. In it was a match. There was buzzing now, urgent, coming closer. Caitlin shouted out the opening, "I live in Madison! I live in Madison, Wisconsin!" Her voice carried past the thin walls, echoing loudly, but only the clouds heard it. Cupping his hands around his mouth, Dan shouted, "Uncle Frank, help us!" "Who's that?" "My uncle. He's down there fishing." She struck the match, and in its flare something moved behind her, a green glow. As he watched, it resolved itself into the slanted shape of an insect eye, but huge. It was right behind her, just inches away. It glittered and disappeared into the shadows. And then the match burned out, and then something slid up under his shirt and slithered along his chest. He heard Caitlin gasp, heard a scream explode out of her, and screamed himself, screamed with all his voice and soul. Arms came around him, and a prick-like fire penetrated his chest, went deep, made him gag, and filled his mouth with a taste like a dead thing smells. Now he could not move, could not make a sound. He felt himself being carried, felt his stomach twisting and knotting, until gorge came up into his throat. He could see nothing, hear nothing except Caitlin breathing in little shocked cries. There came a hand, extended into a faint light, as if it was meant for him to see. A long hand with fingers like naked branches, each tipped by a black curving claw. In this hand was a kitchen knife with specks of rust on the blade. The knife came down on his chest, pricking, then, as the tip of the blade ran along his abdomen, tickling. In the dark nearby, he heard a slicing sound, then a crack, and a bubbling of breath being sucked through liquid. Then a coldness came that extended from his neck down to his groin, and he saw the handle of the knife, which was being used like a saw. As it rose and fell, a coldness grew in his chest. Then, with a sucking sound, two great white things were lifted away from him. He raised his head, looking down at himself. What he saw was so bizarrely unexpected that he just stared. He saw what looked like a wet hamster curled up in the center of his chest, shivering furiously. It lay in a pool of ooze. On either side of it, things like big rubber bladders were expanding and contracting and hissing as they did so. Freezing cold and deadly weak, he fell back, his head hitting the hard iron of the bedstead upon which he had been laid. Then stars came, millions of tiny stars, all gold and green and speeding like sparks on a windy night. They surrounded the children, swirling around their bodies. They moved with the grace of a vast school of fish, swarming through the body of one child, and then into the air, then through the body of the other. Again it happened, and again, and each time the stars invaded the profound nakedness of their open bodies, the veins and organs glowed. Light poured from their screaming mouths, blasted out of their ears and eyes. The children struggled but could not rise, screamed but were ignored. The torture, terrible, somehow beautiful, went on.
Halfway across the continent in Colorado, a young officer picked up a phone and called Washington.
"Sir, we have a Glowboy hovering over Madison, Wisconsin."
"How long?"
came the tired voice of Lieutenant Colonel Michael Wilkes.
22 minutes, sir. Shows no sign of moving."
Wilkes glanced at his watch. Pushing 4 in the morning.
"You were right to inform me,
"Lieutenant Langford, sir."
"Yes, thank you."
He put down the phone. The spruce-sounding young lieutenant would order a jet up if the Glowboy stayed very much longer. Couldn't have one of the damn things lingering over a major metro area after sunrise. Mike wondered what deviltry it was up to, sighed at his own helplessness, then tossed a pill out of a bottle, knocked it back with a glass of water he kept at his bedside, and hit the sack again. He might request Eamon Glass to ask Bob about the stationary Glowboy, but probably not. Bob was one of the 2 living greys they had acquired during an extraordinary incident in the New Mexico desert, when one of the greys' craft had crashed after it had moved into the range of powerful new radars being tested at White Sands. They had not expected these radars to be there, and their ship's ability to stay aloft had been affected. The Air Force had raced to the site of the crash and recovered 2 greys alive, 1 dead. 3 were a triad, the equivalent of a single human being. Without their third partner to complete their decision-making process, the 2 that remained alive had been relatively helpless, and the capture had been a brilliant success. Unless, of course, it was instead an even more brilliant deception on the part of the Greys. You communicated with Bob and Adam via thought, or rather, Eamon, who was the only person they'd ever found who could manage it, communicated with them. Somehow the man used his mind to exchange pictures with them. It was a very strange business, and nobody was sure if it was even really working, but it was all they had. And some of the technological information Eamon had gotten from the creatures was making valuable scientific sense, so there had to be something in it. But they could not find out what the Greys did with people. It was awful, though, that was certain. Awful, and it came from the sky, and the Air Force couldn't do a damn thing about it. So it was secret, and would remain secret. He groaned, turned over, waited miserably for the pill to work. In the silver vehicle, the children struggled, twisting and turning in their captivity. Dan saw something white. He looked at it, trying to resolve its meaning in the haze that still obscured his vision. It was very dark, but he could still see this thing. It dangled as if it was hanging on a clothesline, and he thought it might be a big sheet, wet, because it was dripping, the drops pinging on metal somewhere below. It was a very strange sort of sheet, though, because it had a kind of face, a mouth gaping like that of a big lake bass, with 2 distorted black sockets above it. Were they eye sockets? He thought they must be, because there was also a darkness above them that looked like it might be hair. Then he saw curliness to it and a lightness, and he knew that it was blonde hair, and he had seen blonde hair on Caitlin when she lit the match. He tried to say her name, but there was only a gusty whisper. He wanted his mother. He wanted his dad. He wanted Uncle Frank, who was damn tough, to come up here and help them. Drip, drip, drip. Then he saw that there was another one, and it had short brown hair, and its face was all wobbled like a mirror in the crazy house at Madison Playland. When he stared at it, though, he knew it was his skin. But if it was up there, and he was down here, then... His stomach churned, his heart began raging in his chest, and his throat became so dry it felt as if it had been stuffed with ashes. He wanted to scream, he wanted to beg God for help, but he couldn't make a sound. Off in the dark, a buzzing sound started. The things in the dark were coming. He looked, but he knew he would not see them. He never had. Then his skin flew up and out, and spread like a huge cloud above him, a cloud with a gaping mouth and holes for eyes, and it came down on him as gently as dew falls when you are camping under the stars, and enclosed him in the deepest warmth he had ever felt in his life. He uttered a long, delicious groan of raw human pleasure and profound relief. Beside him, Caitlin groaned too, and he knew that she had as well been covered once again in her own skin. Instantly, without them going out through a door or anything, the silver ship was rushing away overhead, turning into a dot. Wind screamed around them, their hair blew, and Dan thought they'd been pushed out and were going to die in the lake. Below, Mr. Amers saw beams of light playing out of the summer clouds.
"What the hell?" he said.
Then Frank said,
"Oh, got a strike going here."
They brought up another bass. Dan woke up screaming. He was upside down and the covers were all over the room. He got out of bed, immediately felt incredibly thirsty, and went into the bathroom and drank and drank. His mother heard him and came in behind him. "You okay, Dan?" Then he cried, clutching her with all his might, burying his face in her nightgown that smelled of cigarettes and gin. "Hey, hey there. Mom, I had a dream. It was real bad, Mom." She went into his room with him and sat at his bedside. "It was these Indians. They got us and they skinned us alive." "Skinned who alive?"
Me and her. I don't know. Me and this girl."
A cool hand touched his forehead. "You dreamed you were naked with a girl, and that's a little scary, isn't it?"
"The stars," he said. "The stars."
But what about the stars he could not recall? He closed his eyes, and his mother's hand on his brow comforted him. But deep inside him, down where screams begin, there was a part of him that remembered every terrible moment and would never forget. His mother, drunk though she was, sad though she was, sat a while longer with her child, then went back down to the kitchen and resumed her mechanical and relentless assault on a bottle of cheap gin. Caitlin found herself on the floor naked and covered with sweat. Not understanding how she had gotten there, she scrambled to her feet and found that she was afraid to look in the mirror, terribly, agonizingly afraid. She stood, her head bowed, holding onto the sink and crying bitter, bitter tears. Her mind could not seem to make sense of what had just happened. Why was she naked? What was she doing on the floor? Who was that boy, and why did she remember a boy at all? She returned to her room, found her nightgown, and put it on. She went to her window seat and sat down and watched the moon ride low over the lake and smelled honeysuckle on the air. Then she was sick and ran into the bathroom and threw up. She washed her face, brushed her teeth, and finally saw in the mirror her own haggard face. As if she was seeing a miracle, she touched the glass. Tears beaded in her eyes and rolled down her cheeks. She went to her bed then and lay down, and slept the dismal and uneasy sleep of a captured soul. 2. On a sour October forenoon in 2003, Lieutenant Lauren Glass watched her father's coffin being lowered. She was now alone, given that her mother had abandoned them when she was 12. Returned to Scotland and no longer communicated. Also at the graveside were four men, none of whom she knew. They were, she assumed, members of whatever unit he was involved in. She did not know its name, what it did, or anything about it at all. The wind worried the flowers she had brought. The chaplain completed his prayers, and she threw a clod of earth and said inside herself, "You will not, you will not." And then she cried. He had died on duty, somehow. She had not been told how. She had not been allowed to see his body. The coffin was sealed with federal seals, warning that it was a crime to open it. Lead solder filled the crack beneath its lid. She had wanted to at least be alone with it for a short while, but not even that had been allowed. There had been no obituary, nothing to mark all he had done in this world, what she believed must have been a heroic life. She had been given a $5,000 death benefit, and he had been listed as killed in action. Killed how? In what action? He'd left home as usual that morning, then driven to his work, she assumed. They lived on Wright Pat, in Dayton, but he commuted to Indianapolis on the days he worked, which were sporadic. As the ceremony concluded, to her amazement, a missing man formation flew overhead, wheeling majestically away toward the gray horizon. Then, down at the end of the field, an honor guard she had no idea would be there, fired 21 times. The highest salute. Taps were sounded. He was being buried with the highest of honors, and she felt bitter, because she did not know why. The four men were walking away from the grave when she caught up with them. "Can you tell me anything?" Nobody answered. "Please. I'm his daughter. Tell me at least, did he suffer?" One of the men, tall, so blonde that he might have been albino, dropped back. "Should I say no?" "You know how he died?"
"I know, Lauren."
He knew her name. But who was this man in his superbly tailored civilian suit, as gray as the autumn clouds, with his dusting of white hair, and his eyes so pale that they were almost white as well? "Who are you? Can you tell me what my dad did?"
"I want you to come to an office. Can you do that?"
"Now? Is this an order?"
"I'm so sorry. Are you up to it?"
This walk across this graveyard was the saddest thing she had ever done. She did not understand grief. It was a new landscape for her. Could you go to an office in grief? Talk there in grief? In grief, could you learn secrets? "I want to be at home," she said. He gave her an address on base.
"You think about it. And I want you to bear in mind that we wouldn't be asking this if..."
"I know. It's urgent. Obviously it's urgent."
"I'm Lewis Crewe," he said. "If you don't mind, please do not mention the appointment to anybody or my name."
"Okay," she said. "Will you tell me what happened to my dad?"
He gave her a long look, long enough to be disquieting. He was evaluating her. But why? She had no clearance. She was a lowly procurement officer. She had not cared to follow her dad into Air Force intelligence.
"Will you?" she asked again.
"I'm so sorry to have to ask you to come in on a day like this."
"So am I."
She walked away from him then, passing among the neat lines of identical military graves, into which the Air Force had poured so many lives, in so many steel coffins, most of them too young, too innocent, too good to die the sorts of improbable and terrible deaths the Air Force had to offer. It was duty that had taken them. Duty, always, her dad's breath and blood. "The oath, Lauren. Never forget the oath. It might take you to your death. And if it does, that's where you have to go."
She'd thought, "If some stupid president sends me to some dumb country where we shouldn't even be, is it my duty to die there?" She'd known the answer. Had Dad died a useless death? She hoped not. She hoped that the missing man formation was more than just a passing honor. Her life with her dad had not been perfect. Eamon Glass could be demanding, and he had not been happy with the way her career was unfolding.
"You need to push yourself, Lauren, Air Force style. Be ready when it matters. Be willing when it counts."
Boy, was he out of it. He was part of another Air Force, as far as she was concerned. In her Air Force, the main issues were things like padded bills and missing laptops, not duty and dying amid huts and palm trees. "Who were you, Dad? Why did this happen?"
Dad had nightmares. God, did he have nightmares. Screaming cyclones of terror from which he could not awaken, and you couldn't get near him. He'd belt you, and then in the morning be so upset by what he had done that he'd be in a funk for days. Often he would ask if he'd said anything in his sleep. It worried him, obviously worried him a lot.
She'd listened for some meaning in the screams, but never found any. She got in her car and started it, eager for the heater to drive out the deep Canadian cold that was sweeping down the vast plains from the north, shivering the naked trees and the stubble-filled fields. She drove home across the great gray base to their apartment. She stood in the living room thinking how anonymous it all seemed, the inevitable landscape on the wall, the not-too-challenging books on the shelves, the oldish TV, and his chair, big and comfortable, and beside it the magazine rack, filled with Time and the National Review and National Geographic. All so ordinary, and yet so filled with him, that every step deeper into the place was a step through more memory and greater loneliness. She made coffee and was drinking it when she realized that it was Dad's mug in her hand that did it. She cried again. These, she knew, were the anguished tears of the bereaved, that belong both to grief and defeat. She had a last confession of love that must remain frozen in her forever. Most importantly, there was the conversation that had been their life together, that could never now be brought to rest. A whole career. And there had only been 5 people at his funeral. But it hadn't been announced in any way, so his unit was not large, obviously. A colonel looked about 50 with the name tag Wilkes. A younger one, Lieutenant Colonel Langford, maybe 38. Then a civilian, dumpy, wearing an ill-fitting suit. He'd cried, the civilian had, silent tears that he had flicked away as if they'd been gnats landing on his face. And then Mr. Crewe, tall, no way to tell the age, looking a little like the Swedish actor Max von Sydow. Great suit, and those eyes. White-gray. Unique. Dad's people. His co-workers. She shook her head, considering the little collection of silent men. She went into her bedroom and lay down, closing her eyes and contemplating what the voyage of her life would be like now. Dad had had one of those stealth tempers that would boil up out of nowhere and, for a few minutes, rock the world. He had been bitter about never making general. It's the damn work I do. Nobody else can do it, and it's not a general's job. He had hated it and loved it. He would drink at the kitchen table, lifting shots of vodka, and then he would be poetic, which was beautiful and awesome and scary, because he had such a huge memory for quotations, and because when he was like that, being with him was like looking into the darkest room in the world. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, she could hear him reciting, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and then looking at her and adding, Pardon my bathos. Oh, hell, she said, I am going to miss you. How could he be dead? How in God's name do you get KIA'd in Indianapolis? Well, hell, as far as he was concerned, the day she received her commission, she had been on her way to general. He would manage her career. You can't fly combat, so you need to get on a hot staff. He had stared at her orders to report to the supplies depot for a long time. Stood there and stared, so still. She thought he might have gone to sleep on his feet. He put them down far too carefully, on the back of the couch. Then he had marched off into his office. She'd heard him yelling and gone to his door, which was not right, she knew. But she was involved, for God's sake. She'd only heard one thing, but it had been repeated a number of times. Put her on ice. And he'd cursed the person at the other end of the line with a venom that was far beyond his worst tantrums, that had frightened her, because it had implied that the hidden thing in his life somehow also involved her. Thinking back, she closed her eyes for a moment. Fortune and men's eyes. There had also been another thing between her and Dad, that would come at moments of silence and his strange sorrow, a kind of bond that would seem to enter the air between them, almost as if they could somehow link their minds. Or so she imagined.